Hi, everybody. This is Micha Sifri from Personal Democracy Media. Happy New Year, and welcome to the first in our 2012 series of Personal Democracy Plus conference calls with movers, shakers, thinkers, doers in the political technology space. This call is coming to you thanks to our sponsors at Microsoft. We appreciate their support. And I'm very excited to welcome to the call John Tolva, the Chief Technology Officer of the great city of Chicago and a good friend of Personal Democracy, who's spoken at several of our conferences back when he was in the private sector working for IBM on their Smarter Cities program. And now he's actually in the midst of the, really taking Chicago, I think, further into the 21st century than maybe any other city in the United States. That's what we're really going to dig in to on this call today. So welcome, John.
Thanks.
And thanks for making the time to talk with us. And, John, I should say your Twitter handle is Immerito, I-M-M-E-R-I-T-O. Before we dive in, I have to ask you to explain, what is Immerito and why is that your hashtag?
Well, that's my personal account.
Your Twitter handle.
Yes, that's my personal account. The other one is Chicago CTO. But so in a former life, I was actually an English PhD student, and that is the name of a narrator in the epic poem The Faerie Queen by Edmund Spenser. The English Renaissance was my focus.
I see.
Well, that's a whole other
call on that topic. So, why don't you take the first couple of minutes to, you know, describe, you know, you've been there now a little bit over half a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's your mandate? You know, what is the Chief Technology Officer of Chicago actually do? And then let's get into your, you know, your vision and how you're starting to implement.
Sure.
It would be great to really lay it out and then we'll get to things like Chicago snow and and what to do about that.
Well, it's a role that didn't exist previously, so that's good and bad. There is a CIO in the city that is more operational, you know, running systems and things like that. But my role and then another one called Chief Data Officer were brand new. I think in part it was the mayor's experience in federal government as the chief of staff for the president in creating the first federal CTO, that he said, you know, we need some sort of policy level or cabinet level technologist or technology perspective. And the mandate, as you asked, Micha, was pretty broad. You know, set high standards from the mayor's office out for open and participatory government. And we interpreted that in a couple different ways. You know, a lot of that has to do with open data, and I think that early on the mayor's grasp of that was around transparency and accountability, you know, the sort of bedrock of open data. But I think where we've been able to push it now in just a little over 7 months is more towards analysis and actually even economic development coming from open data. Which, you know, is music to anybody's ears in the recession. So we've pretty much operationalized and pushed down to the departments a kind of standard operating procedure of publishing data. So, and that's a good thing. I mean, we really didn't want the mayor's office to be you know, hounding, you know, commissioners, you know, for the next 4 years. So that's enabled us to do things like really focus on tools, really focus on mapping and exposing the data in interesting ways so that people could build things from them. That paired with a really proactive effort to get out into the community, community groups, neighborhood groups, anybody who this data should be actionable for, to kind of listen to their concerns or give tutorials. 2012, I think you could characterize as the year that we pour most of our effort into making this data actionable. So, you know, there's plenty of other things going on. We're implementing something called Open311, which is a way of kind of platformizing service requests. And I think that that's going to be a pretty radical change for the city in the way that, you know, sort of transit specifications have, you know, changed the way people use public transit. I think once you start exposing at every step along the process of, you know, the service request and fulfillment with the city, it opens up some pretty interesting things. And then, you know, I'll just also note that this open data initiative is really the driver behind like a new ecosystem startup that we're very interested in promoting, which is, you might call it a civic startup, right? So a company that is not working directly inside a government, but working with the data that it gives off to provide some sort of value either back to the government or to residents. And, you really are seeing these startups with things like See, Click, Fix and others. But, you know, an interesting example locally is a bunch of guys got together when we released our lobbyist data. So it's basically ethics data. And, it's comprehensive, but let's face it, it's a database. And they built a really usable site on top of it called chicagolobbyists.org, which is very useful. Well, then subsequently, unrelated to that, the city released an RFP to build a new internal ethics database. Mm-hmm. And these guys, all of whom have day jobs, decided to propose, to submit for it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Merely based on the subject matter expertise that they gained in creating chicagolobbyists.org. So in some ways, you could add a fifth thing onto why open data, which is to actually change the skills mix of the vendors that we interact with over time.
Right. Well, I wonder if we should get into the weeds, but why not? I mean, the folks who submitted that proposal, it's pending, or has it already been decided?
No, it hasn't been decided, and I'm actually not part of the review team. But
well, obviously, or else you wouldn't be talking about
no.
it.
No. No, it has not been decided.
It has not been decided. That's very interesting. So that is something that to watch. You know, just putting on my Sunlight Foundation advisor hat for a second, Sunlight, the labs team, looked at trying to bid on government contracts, as a lot of the open data initiatives of the administration began a few years ago. And one of the first things that they discovered was there were just a ridiculous level number of hoops mm-hmm. to jump through to even qualify to be a government contractor. And they said, the heck with this. There's like a steel wool fortress up around the federal government in terms of, you know, small, nimble
yeah.
groups. Maybe Chicago can show a different way of doing that. It's definitely worth watching.
We're not the only city, actually, that's trying to move from this kind of vending machine model of, you know,
mm-hmm.
put coins in, get service out. I think you're always going to need internal technology. There are just enterprise needs for running an organization this big. But I love now that it's being paired with a more platform-based model.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, CicloFix is a great example of, especially in mid-sized cities, where the publication of you know, service request data allows a business to thrive on the periphery of government rather than being right in the middle of it.
Right.
And I think it's a good corrective, actually, for, you know, for the big enterprise IT.
For sure. For sure, and the fact is some of these bigger enterprises are in the process of being disaggregated because there are a lot cheaper ways of doing this.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about the history of open data in Chicago for a second, just because you are standing on the shoulders of earlier efforts of folks both within government and around it to start to expose this information, the civic data that the city collects,
mm-hmm.
and make it available. I'm sure you're familiar with the history of ChicagoWorksForYou.com mm-hmm. that people like Daniel O'Neill worked on. That was, you know, an earlier effort supported by the mayor's office than to, for example, make it easy for the public to see, how many pothole requests for service were coming in and at what rate were they being fixed. And, you know, Daniel once told me how, you know, this project got pretty far along until it got shown to the aldermen, who are the, you know, the equivalent of the city council representatives in Chicago. And they needed to approve it, and they said, no, there's no way this is going to be made public, because the last thing they wanted was for their political opponents, the potential political opponents, to be able to say to voters, look, you know, look how long it takes for potholes to be fixed, or, you know, this guy's got a 10% rate of potholes not being fixed within 30 days, you know, mm-hmm. throw him out. What's changed in the bloodstream of Chicago politics that now you can not just put this data up, but make it really easy for people to do comparisons and my goodness, even show people, you know, on a nightly basis, you know, new reports on things like crime. I mean, yeah. Is it just the times? Have the aldermen all rolled over? Is this a sign of Rahm Emanuel's incredible persuasive abilities? What do you think is going on?
Well, there was a significant turnover in city council, but I think it has to do with the mayor. I mean, the very first thing out of his mouth at the very first cabinet meeting was, we're publishing performance data weekly, mm-hmm. you know, publicly. And so that wasn't mm-hmm. necessarily a statement to the aldermen, but was to the commissioners. But it certainly filters down. I mean, you had a number of aldermen actually who ran on, you know, a kind of transparency, who built some apps actually as candidates, those sorts of things. So in part, I think it's in the water. But you know, this couldn't have been, you know, this couldn't have been done without, you know, really strong executive support of it. I mean, I
have you run into resistance? I mean, you know, I don't know if you can talk candidly about it, but are you seeing pockets of resistance?
Yeah, and specifically, the alderman is a really interesting case. So the 4311, you actually called your ward office when you wanted, you know, something done, pothole mm-hmm. filled, that sort of thing. And even though they were then, the ward office was then interacting with a centralized city service, say, you know, CDOT or Streets and Sanitation, it was, you know, kind of a personalized local interface, if you want to call it that. So 311 came around and, you know, basically took that away, except that, you know, the proprietary service we're using is totally opaque. And it's not just opaque to residents, it's opaque to the aldermen. So now, instead of, even though you call 311 or get it online to have your pothole fixed, if it doesn't get fixed, you know, I'd say 8 times out of 10, you call your alderman. And they're in a bind as well. One of the reasons for implementing Open 311, or, you know, possibly easily as important as empowering residents, is giving the aldermen the ability to create sort of customized dashboards, ward-specific, so that they can, you know, it's almost like a re-decentralization of service request fulfillment. Obviously, it's all going through centralized systems, but now the ability to see where a request is at any point really gives the aldermen back some of the control that they had previously. You know, Chicago Works for You didn't have that kind of visibility into the system. But, you know, I think there is a sense here that, and I've heard this actually in city council, that anything that we can do to make request fulfillment easier is good for them, both politically and, you know, for their residents.
So there's been a larger shift in the culture that's permeated, at least. I'm very excited to hear that. You know, we're certainly right now, I think a lot of folks who pay attention to the we government space or open data are looking at Chicago as probably you know, the best case scenario in terms of just aligning leadership and people like you with the smarts and private sector experience, as well as a developer community mm-hmm. in the city, you know, to begin to show what can be done. Why don't you talk to us a bit about this snow shovels site? Seems like a bit of a you know, fairly mundane topic to sort of stake, you know, such a big push around, but the New York Times gave you a very nice story earlier this week. How did that come together, and what are you trying to achieve with it's snowshovels.org, right, or Chicago Shovels.org,
right.
Yep.
Well, it was actually a number of things. One is that we had been looking at one of the things we're doing internally is looking at optimizing all of our fleet movement. And this, again, is a ward issue. You know, it's the delicate balance between a ward-based system, let's say for refuse or recycling pickup, versus grid. And, you know, you can apply analytics to this. Certainly the private sector and delivery companies have done this forever, you know, eliminating left-hand turns and those sorts of things. And while we were doing that for the in preparation for the snow season, we thought, you know, there's no reason not to expose this. We have traffic tracker, train tracker, bus tracker. It just makes sense. Partially, can you get useful information out of it? Yeah, you could see when a plow is going to turn into your neighborhood streets. Can you do analysis? You know, could someone sufficiently motivated actually look at the patterns? Yes, and I hope they do. But really, it's to show how hardworking these guys are. I mean, and that they're out there right as things are happening. So in part, this is just a kind of an accountability thing. We've been tracking those trucks, and we tweak their routes for years with GPS. So, you know, it actually wasn't that difficult. But the other piece of this was about the areas of the city that the city doesn't shovel. So that's primarily sidewalks. It's also the alleys that we have here. And it's actually city ordinance. You're required to shovel your sidewalk. And so one way of doing that, you're familiar, I think, Mika, with Code for America. City of Chicago is a recipient of that next year. They're doing the Open 311 implementation. But last year, during the blizzard in Boston, the Code for America team there, they're on kind of a 20% plan like Google. They can work on their own things. They built something called Adopt a Hydrant, where you could claim a hydrant and just shovel it out during the season. And we saw that and thought, you know, we could do that a little more expansively. And we built Adopt a Sidewalk on top of this open source code from Boston. And so basically this Adopt a Hydrant functionality at Chicago Shovels allows you to, you know, there's a little bit of game mechanics in there. You claim it, you clear it. There's a little bit of, you know, if it scales up, you know, the ability to roughly, you know, project how much snow was cleared. We know how much fell. We know how wide a sidewalk is. But it's also an actual tool for our volunteer corps. I mean, there are people who legitimately need to be shoveled out, and they can't, you know, the people with disabilities, infirm and elderly. And so we use that map now to deploy this volunteer corps to where it's needed. There's a bunch of other apps there, too. And I guess, you know, of interest to this call, two of the most useful apps there were not built by the city at all. They were built by, you know, third-party interested residents. One's called wasmycartoad.com, which, you know, shows you relocations and things like that. It, you know, it does one thing only. You put your license plate in, and it shows you where your car is. And the other is called 2 Inches. So we have a we have the ability to put a parking ban in place if the snow gets over 2 inches. It's not used all that often, but when it is, you know, it can catch you unawares. And so this allows you to put an email address in, and it'll send you a note if that goes into effect. You know, so those are the main applications. It's kind of a neat story of sharing all the way around, right? We got the code from somewhere else, at least the Adopt a Hydrant from Boston, modified it. The code itself is about sharing. I didn't mention that one of the functionalities of Adopt a Hydrant is you can see where people are willing to loan shovels and salt and things like that. It's a local company here called OsoWe that does that. And then, obviously, we put that code back in the Civic Commons repository or will after we, you know, put it through its paces in the first snow event.
Right. So I want to just take one more, you know, drill one iota further into this, because whenever I talk about the idea of engaging the public, you know, not just engage the developer community, which is a very powerful group of people if you can, you know, get them helping to paint your fence with you, you know, that's a wonderful thing. But when I talk to people about, say, you know, involve the public in, you know, identifying where potholes are, or in these cases, involve the public in helping to shovel each other out, one of the first things I often hear, and this really isn't a tech question so much as it is a social question, is, oh, great, what happens when the first person sues the city because the city facilitated, you know, a connection to somebody who, you know, then robs them, or, you know, they were out reporting a pothole and they, you know, tripped and, you know, broke their leg. How do you get around the, you know, do you need a community manager role here too? I mean, you know, if you're going to tap the ability to crowdsource here and do community organizing, is there a community organizer as part of your team? You know, what happens if you have a big snowstorm and, you know, 20,000 people all volunteer through the site, and then, you know, who's going to stay connected with them? Where's your thinking on that?
Yeah, so we do have a social media director who kind of herds all that, but we also have a chief volunteer officer who's in charge of the volunteers specifically. You know, it's a really good question. So just yesterday we were going over a design point in Adopt a Hydrant where multiple people can claim the same parcel, and that's fine. It's probably going to make it be clean more often. And the question was, do we allow those people's names, could be pseudonyms or however you authenticate it, to be linked to their, say, Facebook account? And for the time being, we're saying no, actually. The social network is going to be the sidewalk itself. If you've all claimed this parcel, you know, and you mean it, chances are you'll bump into each other out there. And that's the level of social – I mean, quite frankly, that's the best kind of social networking there is. Maybe we'll change that. You know, if you use Facebook to log in, you know, then, you know, a link to your profile becomes live. You know, just like anything else, we ran this by corporate counsel, and, you know, they didn't see any problems with it. Other questions arise about, you know, does this in any way invalidate a resident's responsibility to shovel their walk if someone else claims that they've done it, you know?
Right.
And the answer is no. You, the owner, are still required, no matter who's signed up to do it.
Right.
So we work through those things, and, you know, we really do. I mean, the mayor's office and each of the departments has had, you know, a number of months now to build up pretty significant social communities around them. So, you know, it's really, I think there's basically two people who are full-time on that, and then each department has basically the equivalent of a community manager, if you want to call it that.
But so far you've avoided taking the approach of we're going to build a social network platform for city residents to connect to each other around civic issues through us. In other words, you're going to use their email address, people sign up, and then maybe let them affiliate through private services like Facebook. But it's not like the city as social network itself. Is that a deliberate decision? Because this is just the path of least resistance. I mean, you know, I don't want to add more work to your plate, but is there a reason for the city not to put itself in this role?
I think it's two things. One, we didn't look at it as why should we not do this, more as you know, what are the pros for using Foursquare, which the major platforms are Foursquare, Twitter, and Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And then integrating those deeply into things like ChicagoBudget.org, so which was a very vibrant conversation about the 2012 budget with Facebook functionality kind of interwoven. But the other piece, and I'm very serious about this, is that the built environment is what technologies can we be using to make the built environment, the actual physical city, be that platform, that social platform?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the things I think about a lot, especially as we're moving into snow season, is I think you remember the blizzard last year basically shut down Lakeshore Drive, and there were people, you know, stranded on buses for hours. Some of those folks, I mean, there's a lot. I have a friend actually who keeps in touch with three of the people that she met on that bus who, you know, 20 minutes before the storm hit were perfect strangers. And I think about that from time to time. It's like, what could we be, you know, how can we activate that sort of latent, you know, networking or, you know, just conviviality? When it's not the middle of a crisis, you know, and you see a little bit like the mayor did a Facebook Live, like a video town hall early on, and you know that was fine. There were lots of people watching it, but what was more interesting was the conversation that was happening, you know, powered by Facebook down the gutter, where you had people from, you know, really diverse parts of the city, people who would not normally intersect on a transit route or in any other way, having almost completely, you know, level-headed conversation. And I thought, gosh, that I'm trying to think where in the city I could go to hear that in person. I couldn't think of too many places. So, you know, one of the things we're trying to think about is how to activate that with technology out in the real world.
Well, how about letting people affiliate to their subway stop or to their bus stop?
Yeah, although, and that's fine. I mean, I love transit as a, you know, proxy network. The one of the issues with that is you can, those can be networks of affinity, especially if you are, you know, certain stops are only serving one kind of a neighborhood, right? I mean, you really want something that cuts across many. I mean, you know, it's why certain lines are more diverse than others.
I'm not sure it's an either-or choice. I just
no,
it's more
right.
Like,
yeah, you're right.
Where are the cow paths that you know can be turned into real paths because they're already, you know, people are social with each other to a little bit of a degree, and maybe a nudge or you know government stepping in and saying we see an affordance here. We can you know folks who use the same subway stop every day maybe have a greater interest in helping clean it up on the weekend. Than just your random, you know, transit user. You're right, that may not serve the whole city in the way that you want, and you know, those are obviously questions that come up as well. So Chicago Shuffles is still kind of in beta form, right? I mean, we haven't had a real test of the platform yet. I mean, I just went to go sign up, and I can see some pieces are still being worked on.
So load testing, obviously, but that's not the real deal. Like I said, it was like 45 degrees out when I came to work, so it'll probably be a week or more before it gets truly hit.
And has there been money issues about doing all of this that you've encountered? I mean, again, obviously having the mayor support, and you know, you have a fairly strong mayor system there. But you know, have you found yourself needing running out of staff or running out of budget? How do you get things like the buses and the subways, you know, the Internet of Things? How do we start to get all that stuff wired up?
Okay, so you're talking about more broadly than the snow portal.
Right.
It's partially culture change, you know, getting people to think about data as a, you know, driver in policymaking. It's partially about skills mix change, which we're trying to do. So that's not necessarily we need more people, it's we need different skills. Not a lot of open source technology skill here. That's changing. Dan O'Neill, you may know, is now heading something called the Smart Chicago Collaborative, which is a nonprofit that we work with frequently to kind of get us in front of these civic developers, civic nerds, you could call them. Much of the snow portal actually was built by volunteers, in addition to us repurposing what was open source code to begin with from Code for America, just flat out volunteers. I mean, we did have one internal resource who worked on it, but you know, it's the Internet of Things, which you mentioned, is a vastly different thing because that is actually hardwiring city infrastructure. None of that has actually – well, very little of that has been deployed. You know, some of the Internet of Things will be paid for by also using city infrastructure for marketing, you know, for advertising. For instance, our physical bus shelters here are paid for and maintained by J.C. Deco, who does the advertising in them. There may be some sort of similar model there with the Internet of Things, but – I mean, just to answer your question most succinctly, it hasn't been too much of a problem, largely because of the community here that we can turn to if we're really in a bind. That window may close, but it's wide open right now.
Well, as you said, 2012 is your moonshot year. We're right at our halfway point. I'm going to just pause to say, if folks listening, if anybody would like to ask a question. Now's your opportunity. The way to do it is to hit *6 on your phone, and then I will see your number come up on my screen here, and I'll pull you into the call. So we'll give a pause just to allow people to collect their thoughts. But Let me ask you, John, what in terms of what's most surprised you in your, you know, six months, 7 months on the job? Has there been anything that really just blew your mind and made you go, oh, you know, I thought government worked this way, and like, I've completely had my head turned?
Oh, boy. You know, a lot of people, a lot of journalists were like, you know, tell us how bad it is. You know, is the bureaucracy just sucking your soul out? And I was like, I mean, it was about 30,000 employees for the city of Chicago. I just came from a company that had 450,000 employees. You know, that's bureaucracy of a totally different scale. So, you know, that wasn't shocking at all. I guess there really are a lot of very smart, very hardworking, passionate people in the city. And, you know, I guess it's just the sort of in the public imagination, that's not what you think of when you think of at least city workers. Which is a real shame, because they're just some talented people here who are, you know, let's face it, the salary data is all public. They're making less than they can make in the private sector, and to stay here and to do the good work they do means they're doing it for something else, and that's
right.
that comes through.
Right.
So I haven't regretted it one bit. Really, I haven't. I mean, I will admit to you that, you know, there was some soul searching in leaving a company that I very much admired, been there for 13 years, but there's just no looking back. I mean, there is rarely an opportunity to try to implement what you've been consulting others to do forever.
Sure.
So
sure. We both admire you for taking the leap, and we'll be watching closely and hopefully seeing, you know, the results as they start to play out.
Yeah.
We do have hang on one second. I'm going to unmute phone here. Caller, just please introduce yourself and then ask your question. Or phrase your statement as a question.
You're talking to me?
Yes.
My name is Stephen Hallixer. I live in suburban DeKalb, and I have a blog called Digital Governing, which deals with wide aspects of this whole process. But one of the things I've been kind of speculating about is the altering of the relationship between citizens and government that comes with more and more e-gov. In other words, on the one hand, I left a comment on your blog about this, that citizens may have excessive expectations of the efficiency of government response. You know, when you get something like C-click fix, well, maybe things aren't going to be fixed that fast, especially in a time of declining budgets. That's one thing that is kind of interesting to think about. The other thing is this whole process of citizen co-generation, where, you know, we're talking about the Chicago budget and so on. I remember that Governor Quinn opened up a site where citizens could propose changes to the Illinois state budget, that may have been ignored, but a lot of people did post ideas. But once citizens get engaged in the tasks of government, you can't really expect to evict them. In other words, they're going to want more input into government decision-making. So what I'm saying is I think some thought needs to be given to this whole process of altering that relationship and what that might lead to in the future.
Oh, great question. Great question. Stay on. And John, what do you have to say about this?
You know, there are those that, you know, will claim, and I think Mika may be in that group, that, you know, one logical end of a truly networked citizenry is a dismantling of much of the machinery or reconstruction of much of the machinery of government, or even democracy. I think, you know, that is one plausible end to this, because you're right. You cannot evict people once they get in it. And I'll give you an example of that. I mean, people love the open data portal that we have, but we receive some criticism for the process of publication itself not being open. Like, how are you deciding what the next set is? And, you know, my response to that, very, at least in the first couple of months, was we're just getting it out as fast as we can. There really wasn't much thought to it. But it was kind of eye-opening for me, right? You know, here I thought I was being all, you know, sort of transparent, but the actual decision for what to do next wasn't. And you'll hear, I mean, one of the comments, you know, that I've heard is to call it democracy by spreadsheet, which I took that to heart too. I mean, there's really no narrative around some of these sets, no context. So those are just examples of, you know, once people are engaged, they're not going to leave and they're going to keep drilling down. I mean, I'd be interested in your thoughts about what that changed relationship would look like. Assuming the current sort of democratic structures stay in place.
Well, I don't think
if I may
jump
in here, just because I remember Jen Palka of Code for America, the founder of Code for America, riffing on this subject a couple of months ago, and she made a really interesting point, which I think goes to what Stephen is suggesting, which is part of this process of making government more transparent and open and collaborative is it not just a change in the culture of government, but it's also it also requires a change in the citizenry, in that we may have this expectation of instant gratification, right? I paid my taxes. How come my pothole isn't being filled? And that when the information about where all the problems are is made more transparent, that the citizens maybe also need to learn that government is about prioritizing, and that self-government doesn't mean that your pothole gets filled faster than everybody else, because maybe, you know, the one on the corner of a major intersection where, you know, it's causing lots of traffic is a much higher priority. And it's not at all clear how, you know, we get the public, we, the people, you know, start to learn, except through this process that we have to go through too, of, you know, beginning to see that, you know, not everybody's problem is the highest priority.
Mm-hmm.
How do we decide together how to prioritize? So, you know, John, I think you're, you know, not to let you sort of kick the ball back to Stephen right away, but, you know, aren't you kind of creating, you know, by setting loose all this information, you are now creating expectations for a level of engagement that, you know, one or two community managers may not nearly be enough. Maybe the alderman, maybe every community office that the city runs has to, you know, be involved in engaging with the public about all this new information, all this new interactivity, and, you know, where to set their expectations appropriately.
Yeah, I mean, it's very possible. I think we should be careful to say that this is a subset of the citizenry, right? I mean, there's
mm-hmm.
a huge portion of the city that is not expecting the data, that don't know that, you know, Open 311 is coming or give a damn, really.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we think about them as well. But I think that you're right. In some ways, the ward offices are those community managers. And, you know, it's The reason I'm in where I'm sitting and not in the Department of IT is because at the end of the day, this is culture change. And
mm-hmm.
Jen's right. We should turn our, you know, turn our culture change lens in some ways to the people we're serving, as well as the commissioners and the folks in the mayor's office.
Mm-hmm. Steve, do you want to comment or?
Well, you know, I mean, I've studied the whole development of the digital world for years now and observed it very, very closely. And as a historian, you know, I have to tell you, I think we're in the process. We're in what I would call a revolutionary process. And that revolutionary process, the outcome really is almost impossible to predict, just as we've seen the so-called Arab Spring and how that's rolled out. The outcome is almost impossible to predict. But I think, you know, when you say, well, relatively, it's still a relatively small number of citizens who are cued into this, I think you can expect an exponential growth in the number
mm-hmm.
and diversity of those who become engaged.
Yeah.
The tools of the digital world really are, you know, they're democratizing. Mm-hmm. And this is a very critically important thing. We've seen all of the barriers to creation, you know, things like music publishers and book publishers, all of those sorts of gatekeepers fall by the wayside. And I think government really is almost has, in the legislative process and other areas, the government's kind of a last gatekeeper, and it's going to be under siege by new technology. I think we're in a kind of very dynamic situation. It's very hard to sort of predict, you know, where we're going with this.
Well, I completely agree. This is a transitional moment, and I mean, for instance, smartphone usage on the south and west sides of Chicago, places where you'd think that there it would be less than the north side, is actually off the charts. The problem
right.
is, so the broadband digital divide does not exist. The problem is, as far as this is an interaction with city government or city services, it's kind of a second internet, right? It's not broadband. It's sort of throttled by a couple of carriers. So that's a totally different thing. And as we I mean, I completely agree with you that they will be interacting with government online, and the expectations will rise. I'm concerned, though, that you know it all happens on a level playing field when it does happen. I mean, it's inevitable. It's coming.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Stephen, for that question. I'm going to pause. If someone else wants to throw their hat into the queue, just hit *6. And we'll bring you into the conversation. John, I guess I want to ask a question about the mayor's role.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what? We have a question in here,
okay.
So I'll hold on that. Go ahead, caller. Just tell us who you are and ask your question. We have a call from New York. Okay. Hello? You have to hit *6. Make sure you've unmuted your phone.
All right. Sorry. This is Scott Booker with the New York City Department of Education
mm-hmm.
on their school performance and accountability team.
Mm-hmm.
I had a question regarding earlier you mentioned the need for narrative around data, and I think certain types of data place different demands for that narrative more than others. For example, data on infrastructure, time to fill a pothole, for example, it's relatively straightforward in terms of interpretation. Whereas other sources of data, for example, educational data, have multiple measurements and multiple interpretations. You know, even something ostensibly straightforward as test data in determining how well a school is performing, is the principle of doing well and so forth, it is hard to make comparisons without taking account the needs of the student population. How does those measurements differ from measurements the state or the federal government is giving and so forth? So, you know, how do you grapple with those issues?
Great question.
Yeah, so we actually just released report card data basically on schools, and there is a bit more – I mean, the short answer is not as well as we would like. And I would even challenge the comparison to potholes. That a pothole was filled is a pretty simple data point. Why it was, when it was, where it was is something where context would be very helpful. Obviously, you know, at school report cards is a much more meaningful thing. But part of this is about sort of data literacy. You know, you want to contextualize it simply, on the one hand, because there are some well-known simple errors that someone can make in reading a graph or a chart, something like that. You know, units not being normalized and stuff like that. But the other is to give a little bit of story behind this and how it impacts other data sets. So we've built actually a blogging platform that wraps around the data portal that we have now. It's the portal itself is run by something called Socrata, But wrapping that in WordPress, which is something that we learned from the county, quite frankly, they did this before we did, is one attempt at that. So every set that goes up actually lives within a larger narrative. So that's the technical solution to it, you know, allowing the owner of that set and then others, and actually this is something that I worked on at IBM, others to kind of comment and you know, over time add different perspectives to that single set of data. I think that's one way to get at it.
Yeah, thanks. Mm-hmm. Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I want to just to follow up, Scott. Thanks for that question. Stay on if you want to chime in again. But you know, John, what do you do about the bad data problem? Not to pick on schools, but you know, we know there have been scandals where mm-hmm. you know, teachers or principals are erasing and fixing test answers. We know that the cops, say here in my fine city of New York, will, you know, do their best to make the numbers look good, in part by not, you know, reporting when a crime is reported. Sometimes they'll downgrade it so that it doesn't look like crime is going up in their precinct. What are you doing to handle these problems? I mean, you know, you don't want to just build a great infrastructure that massages bad information.
Yeah. So it's two things. One is we actually are running fraud detection analytics. It's mostly right now we're doing that on financial data. I mean, there's mm-hmm. some pretty well-known algorithms that'll identify outliers in what should be a random set of data.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps. But, you know, the shorter answer is exposing this stuff, putting it online pretty quickly shows you where that let's call it error, because there's at least as much just flat-out error than, you know, deliberate malfeasance
mm-hmm.
in this data. And people find it, and find it pretty quickly. And then when you know –
with people meaning who? The government?
The users of the data.
The users of the data
yeah.
come back and – yeah.
And we'll respond that way. That doesn't mean these things are clean, but, you know, the answer is we just – I don't know any other way than to expose it to many more sets of eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's where they'll find it. I mean, what was interesting, after we released 10 years of crime data rolling forward, which is more than any other city, we got a lot of calls from reporters saying, you know, thank you very much. We've been asking for this for years. You know, the FOIA process has been, you know, horrible. And then their very next question was, okay, now point us to the good stuff. You know, where's the good stuff in 4 million rows of data? Assuming that I've even gone through all that. But what I wanted to say was, if I even knew where the good stuff was, you know, I would be committing the sort of same spin that you just releasing a little bit of data here and there, you were crying about for years and years. In my opinion, though, the ability to parse data, whether it is to find you know, malfeasance or whatnot, is journalism right now.
Mm-hmm.
So putting it out there, you know, is, you know, sort of crowdsourced error checking.
Right. Scott, do you want to have a follow-up, or we'll move on to another call if someone else wants to chime in?
I'm good. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right. Well, we've got about 10 minutes left. If anybody listening wants to ask a question, now is your last and best opportunity. I do have a one that I wanted to follow up with, which I'll start to ask in case somebody doesn't chime in the next 10 seconds. So, John, talk to me more about how this is being perceived, how you think you're doing with the public in terms of how people understand, or, you know, do you think that, you know, the media gets it or doesn't get it, and, you know, to what degree are you trying to be your own media? I know, you know, Cory Booker in Newark has this amazing usage of his own Twitter channel. I don't see Mayor Rahm, the real Mayor Rahm, doing quite the same thing. So what are you seeing in terms of how the message is getting out and whether the public and whether the media, number one, and number two, the public, whether they understand that something's going on here?
I do believe the media and the public understand that something's gone. I will say that I don't think we have made the impact with the public yet that we want to. You know, it's just not all that actionable outside the social media channels, which people do like and use. I mean, I think they understand that. We've not done as good a job as we can making the data actionable. You know, making the, let's call them endpoints with government, the ways of interfacing as actionable as they could. So there's some work to be done there.
Give me an example of what you mean by that. That's interesting, but seems a bit abstract.
Well, okay. So you know, there's a community development organization here, a nonprofit called LISC. Actually, it's in New York, too. Local Investment Support something. And they are chomping at the bit to use the crime data to make decisions about how they deploy their, you know, funds and resources with this crime data. And they just don't know how to. They don't know how to integrate neighborhood block level data about the you know, the indicators that give rise to something they would want to correct, joblessness or foreclosure. And that's failure in my eyes, on my end, right? The data is there, but you know, we need a set of tools, a suite of tools, whether we build it or the community builds it. You know, the city plays a role in activating that. So, does that make sense?
Yep, that makes total sense. We may come back to that if we have time, but I do see we have a person waiting to ask a question. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hi, this is Jeff Rizzoka from Regional Plan Association.
Hey,
John, how are you?
Good.
So we all know that data doesn't stop at city boundaries, and you've got some pretty strong communities right next to you. What's the integration with them like, and are you helping to persuade them to open up a little bit?
It's almost like you work for a regional planning association.
I think regional.
Yes, absolutely.
Sorry, Jeff, I'm going to mute you because we just suddenly got some echo, okay?
Is that me?
No, I think it was Jeff echoing. Okay, it's gone away.
Yeah, you know, a lot of the sets that we're publishing actually are cross boundaries. I mean, I think in some ways more than New York. Actually, especially on the west side of the city here, there are routes and services that actually go across suburbs to get back into the city. So we've actually done quite a lot. So the Apps for Metro Chicago competition is the first that I know of that actually was three different governments but focusing on the Chicagoland area. So it was the county, the city, and the state. With Chicago-centric data, and you know, so there's something like 200 municipalities in Cook County, Chicago being the largest. So, you know, I'm not seeing a kind of data.oakpark.org just yet or anything like that. But we get calls all the time from folks. What's really got people hopping is the plow tracker, right? The communities around here want that. So, you know, we're kind of at their you know beck and call, and the calls are starting to ramp up. You know,
right.
How can we
let me squeeze in one more question.
Sure.
Here I've got somebody, it looks like, calling from Princeton.
Yeah, hi, my name is Michael Hertz. My question is sort of a big picture one about the difference between citizens and customers. You know, a lot of what you've been talking about today is about customers, and indeed the huge majority of e-government stuff is about government and its customers and much less about government and its citizens. And I was just noticing that your title at IBM was Director of Citizenship and Technology. So when you were in the private sector, it was citizenship, and now you're in the public sector and it's customers. And is that backwards, or is that sensible? Is there a citizenship agenda you have separate from your customer service agenda? Which do you think your role and technology's role should be focused on?
Great question.
Great question. And actually, there's a funny story about the title at IBM. That was actually short for corporate citizenship, which was the term du jour of, you know, corporate social responsibility.
Right.
I liked the ambiguity of it, though, that in citizenship writ large. It's a great question. I'll say I don't think that I've used the word customer once. I think
no, I don't think you have either.
Horrible way of thinking of people. And one of the earliest ways that I agreed with Mika is in this move from, you know, e-government to we government, I absolutely want to get away from the vending machine model, right, where you put money in and you get a service out, or you don't get a service out and you kick the machine. I'm much more interested in the we actually don't use the term citizens here. They're Chicagoans, whether they're citizens or not. But I take your point. You know, how do you activate them? And I think part of it has to do with, you know, providing the raw materials, in one case data, for them to do things with it, to write applications, to build businesses. You know, why should the city have the only service for reporting a pothole or tracking the bus? Why shouldn't, you know, there be the ability to for anybody to create that? I think that that moves a little bit away from the customer client model.
It's an unfolding process, which we are going to obviously keep a close eye on. I think it's really thrilling, John, to, you know, really, given our relationship, you're having spoken at Personal Democracy Forum a couple times in the past, you know, maybe we'll get you back this June to talk, you know, with a bit more of the perspective of a insider who's trying to get the walls to come down and take advantage of this moment that's starting to unfold. I don't think we're going to get to the bottom of these questions for a while, but folks should know we are going to be watching and listening and reporting on it. But for now, we've run out of time, and I've got to thank you, John Tolva, CTO of the City of Chicago, for spending this hour with us here.
Sure
at
thing.
Personal
Thanks
Democracy
for having
Class.
Me.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks again to Microsoft for sponsoring this call. And everyone else, we'll see you next week.
Thanks, everybody.